in the US, right, we have such a fragmented healthcare system where there's not a lot of innovation in legislation. There hasn't been innovation in clinical treatment. It is so fragmented, but in particular in mental health.
Well, Christine, Mike, thank you so much for being on the show with us today. Christine Sigdalen is the therapeutic area head for mental health at Boehringer Ingelheim, and Mike Jablonski is the VP of clinical development. So I'm really excited to be having this conversation here about the exciting work that you are both leading over at BI. But before we get going, we'd love for you each to maybe give me a thumbnail sketch of your careers and how you ended up doing the work that you're doing today.
Well, first of all, Brandon, thank you so much for having Mike and I here on your show. So for a brief introduction, like you said, I am at Boehringer Ingelheim and I head up our mental health franchise. And I've been here for about 2 years now, 2 years in January. And I was asked to build out this capability from the ground up to get ready for launching several products, to really build out a team, to build out a culture and a vision for Boehringer, because it's a new space for us in mental health. So it was a really exciting opportunity for me to say yes to. But as a short background on my career, I've been in pharmaceuticals and healthcare for over 25 years. And I've worked in different therapeutic areas such as transplant, diabetes, obesity, dermatology, cardiovascular, you name it, I've worked on it. I've worked on nail fungus even. But really my favorite area to be in is in mental health and really making sure that we are making a difference in people's lives. It's also a very personal passion for me, this space, because my older brother actually lives with schizophrenia. He's been living with schizophrenia for over 30 years. I also have a lot of family members who have either been diagnosed with major depressive disorder. My own mother died of Alzheimer's. So this space of CNS mental health is very personal for me. And it's not just a job, it's a mission. And that's why I do the work that I do.
And Brandon, I'm Mike Jablonski. Just want to build on what Christine said. You know, I think here at Boehringer, we have a true commitment to help patients struggling with mental illness as we look and we'll discuss, more details about the work that we're doing here. I think we have a real opportunity to change lives. I'm trained as a neuroscientist, so I did basic preclinical research and development in neurodegeneration, largely ALS, Lou Gehrig's disease, as well as Alzheimer's, Parkinson's, and really moved into psychiatry and clinical development and medical affairs in psychiatry by looking at precision approaches to care, whether that be genetic analysis, other biomarkers. How can we do better to identify these disorders and hopefully develop treatments one day to really help patients suffering from these illnesses?
Absolutely. Well, thank you for giving us that incredible tee up. I'd love to maybe just start high level here. As you see it, what does the landscape of serious mental illness, mental health treatment look like today? And I'd love to hear how you're hoping for BI to kind of play in that landscape.
One of the things that I wanted to talk about is how in the US, right, we have such a fragmented healthcare system, but in particular in mental health, it is so fragmented, right? A lot of the funding comes at the state level. There's not a lot of innovation in legislation. There hasn't been up until recently a lot of innovation in clinical treatment. And what happens is the patients, unfortunately, and family members that care for people living with serious mental illness are left to their own devices. Meaning, when you talk to a healthcare provider, a lot of times that healthcare provider will not know what are some of the benefits that are available, say, for people living with schizophrenia. And so you'd have to do your own research. You'd have to call your insurance company, you'd have to get connected with the community services. You'd have to get connected with non-healthcare providers to help you with case management, people like social workers. So, in general, it's a very complex journey for the patient to go through. And it's also quite fragmented, right? And it's unfortunate that there's a lot of things around the transitions of care that make the patient suffer, right? Because they're not the ones that benefit from this continuum of care that sometimes exists, for example, in oncology. And it's unfortunate, right? Because serious mental illness is an area with such high unmet need. And so part of what we want to do at Boehringer is not just deliver and launch innovative medicines, but we want to be a partner of choice to make sure that we're thinking about how to help a patient and their family member or their families in that journey, right? We're also wanting to make sure that we're not just thinking about clinical treatment, but we're also thinking about it more holistically. So for example, you know, we're not just launching medications, you know, that are taken as a pill or as an injectable, but we're also launching in the space of what's called prescription digital therapeutics, right? So that we can launch software as a medical device to help with negative symptoms of schizophrenia, which is also a high unmet need. And so these are the things that we're looking to do to make sure that we understand the entire ecosystem in which a patient has to navigate through and then be a solution partner where we are able to be a solution partner with. You know, we can't solve for all the problems, but we also recognize that there's so much more that we can do than just launching medications.
Maybe to ask the kind of spicy follow-up question here, how do you think about the role of a manufacturer in increasing access, bringing down some of these barriers, talking about the kind of continuum of care journey that you're just describing, Christine?
I think we can play a major role in the continuum of care, but also creating more access in the sense that, like I said, we can't do it alone, but we can also form partnerships, right? We can form coalitions in the community. And, you know, that's why we have people that work in patient advocacy, as an example, because we know that patients may not listen to manufacturers all the time, right? Maybe there is a distrust in manufacturers, but at the same time, one of the things that we really want to put out there is we are a different kind of manufacturer. Right. We are a family-owned company. We've been in the space of mental health research for over 10 years, but we don't really talk about it as much as other companies, you know, who are publicly traded do. We have a generational commitment to mental health care. We have partnerships, for example, that we just formed with WHO. We also have a partnership, and Mike can talk about this, with Dartmouth. Right. So we recognize that we cannot do it alone. We recognize that there's so much unmet need. And so part of our job is how do we become the hub? How do we become that bridge and bring people together who will want to partner with us? Again, not just to bring the innovations through our research and development, but also the other solutions, the more holistic solutions that patients and their families need.
Now, that might be a good kind of transition, Mike, to you giving us a overview of maybe the kind of research and development philosophy, how you're kind of approaching it over at Boehringer.
Absolutely. And I think Christine put it well in terms of how we're focusing on individuals' needs. And, you know, each individual suffering from severe mental illness along a continuum, you know, is dealing with different issues. And that may be, you know, issues around support systems, you know, our access to care or whatever it might be. But our approach and our research and development approach really follows that same philosophy. How can we meet the patient where they are? How can we address severe mental illness in a comprehensive way, not just delivery of a pill or a medication, but what can we do holistically? And as we think about, you know, our research and development, we're really interested in understanding a precision psychiatry approach. And, you know, without getting too technical, you know, how can we look at the underlying neurobiology that's driving these symptoms? So what is it about severe mental illness or schizophrenia across negative symptoms or cognitive symptoms? And can we understand the biological mechanisms, the brain circuitry that connects the issues that someone is having around negative symptoms or cognitive symptoms with the biology in the brain? And our thought is, you know, if we can approach these precise opportunities to understand these networks, we can target more specifically these symptoms. So that can be across schizophrenia, depression, other indications, you know, and other disorders in the mental health landscape. And by truly understanding those symptoms, you know, we believe that through our R&D efforts, we can address those domains specifically.
I was just going to add that one of the things that we really pride ourselves in, right, is this notion of where are the areas that has the greatest unmet need. And, you know, Mike talked about schizophrenia as a whole. There's already a huge unmet need in schizophrenia, period, right? But really, if we think about the innovations, and again, in the last decade, it hasn't really been that great until recently, where we have new medications for psychosis to treat the positive symptoms. But yet, if you think about it, there's, you know, two other domains, the negative and the cognitive symptoms that are untreated, and I would also say undiagnosed, right? And nobody is researching in that area. Nobody's investing in those areas. And so that's where we go, right? We pick areas where there's not a lot of innovation, and yet you know that there's a huge, huge and high unmet need. And I know we're talking about mental health, but that's also the philosophy for this company to go at other therapeutic areas, right? So we go for the high science, so to speak, but we do it in that, you know, that targeted, very precise way.
Yeah, it reminds me of a conversation I was having with Srini Rao over at Atai. He's saying that if it wasn't hard, if there wasn't an unmet need, it wouldn't be worth doing. And that absolutely resonates. I do want to talk a little bit more about this precision psychiatry approach. Schizophrenia, major depressive disorder, I think of as being kind of different, pretty different even. Is there a unifying kind of theory or framework of precision psychiatry that you look at the kind of landscape through? And I'm kind of curious, how should maybe patients interpret that?
It's a good question, because there's a lot that we don't know about, you know, the field of neuroscience, the field of mental health, and I think we're piecing it together. You know, I might use a different example to think about those underlying transdiagnostic, you know, thought paradigms for neuroscience. And one would be, you know, the take impulsivity, for example. You know, impulsive approaches that span indications. So borderline personality disorder or ADHD, schizophrenia, you know, have underlying impulsive features that exist across, you know, these various diagnoses. And when you look, you know, you can map impulsivity according to that brain circuitry that I was alluding to before. And if you can truly understand what's causing someone to be impulsive and look at the brain characteristics of an impulsive individual, you could start to see similarities across different diagnoses. And I think that's an example that, you know, you may be able to latch onto in terms of how we think about the brain circuitry. Mm-hmm. And then, of course, we have to do the research to understand, you know, is impulsivity across these different diagnoses the same? You know, I don't think we know the answer to that yet. But if we can start to identify impulsive nature and what's leading to that impulsive nature, we can start to elucidate those mechanisms pretty clearly.
But I think we also think about the impact in someone's life, right? So if we think about negative symptoms, for example, where, you know, they have impaired social functioning, you know, they have no motivation, right? The impact of that is they're not in the society, right? Again, I think about my own brother who, you know, it's very difficult for him to do things on his own, you know, without prompting. Also has very severe cognitive impairment. And so he has memory loss, you know, he's not able to follow directions very easily, right? Those things have a burden, not just on the person living with schizophrenia, but it also has a burden and an impact on the caregiver, which is the primary one is my sister, as an example, right? And so it's not something that, you know, we take very lightly, right? Because we recognize that these kinds of impacts in somebody's life, right, has such damning effects, but it also has an amplifying effect, right? Because it's not just about the person. It is about the community that they live in, but it's also the, you know, the people around them that help to support them. And so to me, I think about if a person, you know, again, whether it's schizophrenia or any other condition, is, you know, able to function better, right? It's just better for society, right? It's better for the family, you know? So there's so much more, I'll call it real world evidence, right? That's also needed to make sure that we're talking about these things in very pragmatic terms. And to me, that specificity that, you know, that I think we need to be continuing to think about and move ahead with.
Yeah, and this is a fascinating topic. I just had Jordan Smoller over at Harvard MGH on the show talking about precision psychiatry, you know, thinking about some of these transdiagnostic features. I'm curious, from a developer standpoint here and from a marketing standpoint, how do you think about, I guess, targeting some of these features as opposed to the classic diagnostic categories in the kind of like roadmap and the way that you think about the roadmap of prioritization, but then also like how does that end up like in the hands of clinicians?
Part of what's important here is how do we make this simple for a clinician, and I will also say a non-clinician, I'll explain why, to identify patients who actually have these symptoms, right? And because when you say to, you know, a typical clinician, right, they're going to focus on, we need to control the psychosis. We need to control the positive symptoms. They're not looking at negative symptoms and they're not looking at cognitive impairment, right? Because it's not, there's nothing for it today. But how do you be pragmatic about some of these descriptors? You know, for example, you know, are you noticing that your patients have a hard time following directions? Have you noticed that they have memory loss? Have you noticed that, you know, they're having a hard time keeping on task, right? Those are patient descriptors. And the reason why that's important is because that's, again, more real world. That's more pragmatic. Now, I translate that to, again, a non-clinician, say a case manager, a social worker that works with people living with schizophrenia. They're not seeing the clinical diagnosis, right? They're seeing how these patients are living and what they have trouble with. And so part of what we want to do is create these, you know, these screener tools, right? These very much validated tools to help prescribers, clinicians, non-clinicians to easily identify and to easily diagnose. Not easy, but that's what we're working on.
I would build on that a little bit too, because I think, Brandon, your question's a really good one in terms of how we can really associate, you know, the basic biology with the outcomes to patients is what I hear in the question. And I'll say, you know, Dr. Smoller at Broad has done some incredible work to, you know, look transdiagnostically. Beringer actually just announced a partnership with Broad to investigate cognitive effects in patients with schizophrenia and other mood disorders. And when you consider, you know, the ability to look at that biology, the component that's going to be important is how we translate. And, you know, translational science, I think, is what's really going to lead to intervention that can be successful. And you can look at that basic biology, but until you're able to look at, you know, things, scientific evaluations, imaging, EEGs, you know, to look at how it's translating to cognition, that's really where you're going to see, hopefully, the positive outcomes. And it's that continuum of translational science that I think is going to lead to those outcomes. But I just want to underscore, you know, as we think about the biology and understanding, we need a really strong basis in the biology. And once we're able to get that, I think that's where you start to see the translational aspects of care. And you know, if our hypothesis on this transdiagnostic approach is correct, as a field, you know, we will be able to look at these personalized approaches to care and really individualized treatment that'll impact, you know, the patient's lives, as Christine was describing.
And I think you were also asking about marketing, right? And I'll just say, to us, it's about education, right? So it isn't just about, yes, there's a marketing department, but there's also a medical department. What's common across, right? And there's also patient advocacy, like I mentioned. There's, you know, communications. There's all kinds of functions within Beringer that we're building out to support our mental health franchise. But regardless of the function, what I will say is our goal at the moment, especially now where, you know, we don't really have brands out in the marketplace, is to educate, right? Part of this is increasing the awareness to some of these symptoms that are untreated or undiagnosed. Then, you know, part of that awareness is how do we also at the right time drive action, right? And then with that action comes the outcome, you know, that Mike was talking about. And I think it should, and hopefully, right, it comes full circle, right? Because without the innovation, you know, there's nothing for us to offer. But without the education and really shaping the market and shaping the narrative and the conversation out in the marketplace, then there's not going to be any action, right? So you need all of that to really make all of this work.
It's an interesting jumping off point. What do patients, loved ones, providers have to look forward to here? A lot of progress for the first time. What are the things you're most excited to kind of see evolve and kind of make its way into the hands of the public?
Well, like we've already mentioned, you know, we are hoping for successful outcomes in the area of schizophrenia. We're also looking and developing therapies for major depressive disorder, for bipolar, for impulsivity.
Cognition in general.
I mean, our pipeline, and I know this for a fact, I worked at different companies prior to Beringer, you know, also in the mental health space. We have one of the richest pipelines in the industry. It is absolutely phenomenal. It's fantastic. So again, I think of it as a mission for us. You know, we have to look forward to, again, not just the innovation that we're about ready to bring to the market, but it's also the commitment that we have, that generational commitment that I really do believe is differentiating for us, because there's so many companies that have, I'll call it, failed outcomes in clinical trial, and next thing you know, they're gone. Right. And that's not who we are. Right. That's, like I said, even before I knew, Beringer has been in this space for over 10 years. I had no idea until, you know, recently, right, when I joined. And I was, I tell you, I was pleasantly surprised. And I was also very, very hopeful that there's a company like ours that really want to make a difference to redefine mental health care. It's just, I'm very grateful for that.
Now, I know that BMS Karuna has had a positive outcome recently, AbbVie Cerevel, a negative outcome recently. As you think about the kind of landscape of competition and the progress that's being made, how are you hoping for the work that you're doing in particular to kind of stand out relative to the other work that's out there?
Well, I applaud anyone working in this space, and I think it's really needed. Innovative therapies, you know, approaches to care, anything that we can do as an industry as a whole to help these patients is tremendous. I think, you know, as we consider the areas of unmet need, we talked a little bit about what those are for severe mental illness. Certainly in schizophrenia, we want to look across all of the symptom domains. And as we think about where we may be able to offer something for patients with negative symptoms in schizophrenia, our prescription digital therapeutic, and cognitive impairment associated with schizophrenia with our small molecule clopidogrel. These are defined areas of unmet need, and we see the impact that it has on the function, the day-to-day life, the quality of life for these individuals. Mm-hmm. And I think those are, you know, two specific areas in addition to the rest of the pipeline where we really have an opportunity to contribute to the care and the well-being of these individuals.
You know, I'd also add Otsuka, right? They recently just launched their prescription digital therapeutic for major depressive disorder. Like Mike said, you know, yes, they could be or should be considered as competition, but I really don't see it as that, right? I mean, yes, from a sales and marketing perspective, could be. But I really do see it, like Mike said, as a way for us as a totality of an industry to bring about innovation that is sorely needed. And I hope that much of the success that we will see from these companies, including ours, will be an encouragement to other companies to invest in this space even more. And what I would also say is, again, I talk about partnership all the time. I really believe that there's enough commonality in breaking down some of the barriers, expanding access to care, changing policy, you know, creating more funding at the state level for these organizations like ours and Otsuka and BMS, AbbVie, right, to come together to make some noise to make sure that, you know, mental health care is front and center and that we don't defund or deprioritize in any administration. You know, that's my hope, right, is that there's so much to do. There's so many patients that we need to serve. Not one company can do it all. So we need more.
Yeah, I think that's a striking statement that's and kind of a through line through a lot of these conversations I've been having, which is that no one company can do it all. None of these experiences, conditions are homogenous, which means what we really need is a heterogeneous shelf of solutions for the folks out there who need them. Speaking of deprioritizing, digital therapeutics has hit a bit of a rough patch over the last, let's call it, 3 years, 2-3 years here. But clearly, Boehringer is doubling down on digital therapeutics. Maybe tell us a little bit more about why and what that means.
Well, we talked about access to care, right? We recognize that there's less and less psychiatrists in the market. And, you know, making appointments or getting appointments is becoming harder and harder. And so I think this is one way to expand that access to healthcare for patients. I think it's also a way to holistically treat a person, right? Because it's not just about medication, but it is also about cognitive behavioral therapy. It's also about psychotherapy. It's all these other things that can help, you know, and there's a lot of discussion around the brain's neuroplasticity. Again, Mike is the best person to talk about that. But, you know, sometimes, you know, when we think of, for example, Rejoin, right, where that's what they talk about, right, that the brain is neuroplastic. And so are there ways to transform how the brain functions, you know, and that's what we want to do as well. Again, you know, you have to have, as I call it, many shots on goal, whether it's in prescription digital therapeutics or on small molecules or whatever else, you know, we just have to keep going and we have to drive that innovation and just keep trying. Nothing worthwhile is easy. I think you said that before. PDTs, not easy. But again, we're that company that, you know, hopes to be, you know, that company that is in it for the long term and for the right reasons.
I would add a little bit on the PDT space, because I think we see tremendous potential in the opportunity, as Christine mentioned, to access, you know, a service to individuals that may benefit. I think, you know, from a opportunity of success standpoint with PDTs, you know, we are really trying to collect the efficacy data, you know, that will be needed in an appropriate way. And what I mean by that is, you know, how does it function in the real world? How will we see, you know, this prescription digital therapeutic impacting, in our case, you know, individuals with schizophrenia and negative symptoms? What data needs to exist to convince us that it can be successful? That's from an access standpoint, as well as a clearance standpoint from the FDA. And I really think it's going to take the totality of evidence for these PDTs, you know, to really show the success that they can have.
You know, maybe the one thing that I will add to that that's so needed is coverage, right? If patients and clinicians, for that matter, are not if they're not reimbursed, you know, that really contributes to the downfall of it, right? And I think that's one of the reasons why, you know, Otsuka sort of turned the model on its head, right, where they're offering it as a cash pay, you know, to create that demand, and then, you know, with the hopes that are, you know, the payers will also cover it. That's another element that's very important also.
I'd love to maybe like dive in a little bit into how you even do the research for digital therapeutics. Mike, maybe tell me a little bit about like what is uniquely difficult about running a high quality trial for the impact of digital therapeutics in a population like schizophrenia.
Yeah, I think there's some major differentiators, you know, in terms of a PDT type data set compared to, you know, pharmacological intervention. I would start with, you know, the ability for an individual to continue using a PDT. You know, we need to see utilization and sustained utilization when an individual, you know, goes to their mobile phone, starts to interact with the digital therapeutic. Can we look at, you know, sustained engagement? And that's just step number one. That's not even an outcomes assessment. But are people using the digital therapeutic? Are they coming back to use it? And what's going to make it appealing, you know, to come back and use it? So that's number one. I think implementation is another consideration for a prescription digital therapeutic. How can it best be incorporated into clinical workflow? What does it look like to have access to a prescription digital therapeutic? How can, you know, the patient get that? How will the HCP incorporate it into his or her practice? And how can we be confident, you know, that it's easy for a workflow? As everyone is so busy, we need a simple way to incorporate the PDT. And then you get to efficacy, then you get to the outcomes assessment. And I think that's where in structuring clinical trials, you want to really understand, you know, what's going to be engaging. And, you know, as you would, I think this is where some of the similarities come into play with pharmacological interventions. You know, you want to have an appropriate control. You want to be looking at your intervention and the difference between the two. And I think that's where you have more of the classically controlled, you know, randomized controlled trials that you would want to see to define efficacy. And then the last thing I would say is just from a real world evidence standpoint, you know, how can you look at this intervention in that real world setting? You know, you want it, as I mentioned, to be easy to implement and incorporate. You want sustained engagement, but will it work in the real world in addition to that randomized controlled trial? And I think those are some of the major factors that come into play for a PDT assessment.
So have you just started to build your own in-house product development teams, software engineering, design, all this kind of stuff? It feels like a pretty different set of capabilities than what exists in a traditional sponsor or drug manufacturer.
We do not have that expertise. And so we partner with Click Therapeutics, just like other companies have partnered with them to, you know, develop these PDTs. But we are responsible for commercializing. We're responsible for the strategy, you know, and really, you know, getting it out in the marketplace. But, you know, Click has been, you know, a great partner. You know, we have a few things that, you know, are, you know, in development at the moment. So we recognize that, again, this is part of that partnership that I was talking about, that's important for us.
Yeah. And Christine, I totally hear you that competitor may not be the right word, but let's call it contemporary. Outside of the work that you're doing at Boehringer, whose work are you most inspired by out there in the rest of the field?
I am incredibly inspired by the researchers, you know, that exist across academia that are truly pursuing those translational components to care. You know, I think for a long time in medicine, there's been research for the sake of research, you know, desire to understand biology, which is great and important. But I really, you know, respect the researchers that are pushing the envelope of how are we going to get an understanding of the biology to drive therapies forward. And I think we're seeing a transition in the field where everyone is understanding the obligation that we have to pursue that research and translate it. And I think there are good examples, you know, across the country, across the globe, that are really driving that understanding forward.
I think your question to me, though, is more about what are the companies, right? What are the other manufacturers? You know, it's hard to say. I will say that prior to coming to Boehringer, like I said, I didn't to be very honest, I didn't even realize that Werner was in this space until this opportunity was presented to me, you know, 2.5 years ago. And I was so impressed by that. And it goes back to that research component that Mike was talking about. But I would also say, you know, the other companies like J&J, you know, Otsuka, they continue to, you know, to invest in this space as well. You know, with MS, you know, I look at what they paid for, you know, for the Karuna product. Although I can't speak to their pipeline. I'm not sure how rich it is, right? But, you know, I tend to think about companies like J&J, for example, and Otsuka, who have also been in this space for a long time. And even if their pipeline is not as rich, right, they're trying to buy or, you know, or secure other companies or other molecules that, you know, that can help. And so I think about those companies, right, that have been in it for a long time, but also invest in advocacy, invest in policy shaping, not just bringing medicines to the marketplace. So I look at that in terms of what other investments they're making to really make this a more holistic picture for them. So those are the companies that I think of. But I happen to also work at those companies, and maybe that's why I just know some of the inside baseball that, you know, that you know, we were dealing with.
Well, and certainly some of the work that J&J has done to pave the road for Spravato, and I think some of the work that I'm sure some of these up-and-coming psychedelic companies are going to benefit from is quite inspiring too. Now, I'm surprised neither of you mentioned the breakthroughs happening in psychedelic research.
Yeah, I think it's an evolving space. I think it's a complicated space, and you know, as we consider the opportunity, you know, I think as a scientist, the data will certainly speak for itself.
Mm-hmm. I think of Compass. You know, Compass, the CEO of Compass was the CEO of Otsuka. So he had to have gone to that company for a reason. So yeah, definitely evolving, definitely a little bit controversial as well. Not that different from, you know, what J&J has been doing with Spravato, right? Because that also is, you know, esketamine derivative.
Yeah. And Kabir was actually the one who I think was a strong advocate of this idea of we need a shelf of potential solutions and there won't be one size fits all. And certainly the psychedelic world, I think, is almost fighting back some of the hype that is following it around. Well, I think maybe one last question to kind of leave you both with here. Mike, I'll start with you. If you had a magic wand and you could change anything about how neuro... psychiatry work is researched and done today, what would you like to see changed?
Wow, that's a big question and a lot of opportunity for change, I think. If I had to say one thing, you know, I would really distill it down to I'm really excited about where we're going to be 5, 10, you know, 20 years from now. And if I could wave the magic wand, you know, I would advance us 20 years in terms of R&D and development and similar to other fields of medicine, you know, like oncology. Let's get to a state where we're identifying biomarkers, we're confident in our diagnoses, we're understanding the biological underpinnings of these diseases. So I'm excited where we're headed. I wish we could go faster, but I think we will get there.
And Christine, maybe for you, how are you most excited to see things change over the next 10 years?
You know, I'll answer the magic wand question. I wish that in mental health, in neuropsychiatry, that clinical trials weren't so difficult to achieve success, right? There's definitely a lot more in general, you know, failure in psychiatry, right? Because of the placebo effect. It's just difficult, right? And so how do we make sure that we don't obviously put patients at risk? You know, we still have the rigor of what's needed in a clinical trial, but maybe not. And again, I don't know the answer. You're asking a magic wand question. Like what is it that we need to change to make sure that it is easier to pass through that rigor without putting patients at risk? Because it's unfortunate, right, that you know, because it's a real thing, right, in clinical trials, you know, that placebo thing is, it's real. And so how do we make it easier, you know, without putting patients at risk?
Certainly. You're not the first one to point at the placebo effect and how it's been harder to achieve separation in the work. I want to thank both of you for taking the time out of your afternoon to have this conversation. I've deeply appreciated it. I've been looking forward to this conversation for quite some time. So thank you for coming on the show and having this chat.
And thank you for the opportunity, Brendan. We really appreciate it.
Yeah, thank you so much.
My pleasure.